Radio Canada International presents Only One Earth, a documentary series on global ecology, drawn from the Stockholm meetings on the human environment, with music by Robert Ruzicka and prepared and presented by Alan Yates.
Only one earth, one world for the living. No second chances, no second time around. The sins of the fathers will not be forgiven. For generations they'll live on.
The number of synthetic chemicals added to our environment increases in the sense of new ones of several hundred thousand a year, of which 1,000 or so become in commercial use. But most of them are put in commercial use without adequate testing. So in a sense, we are using the population as a guinea pig, because the tests often are carried out while the substance is being consumed or being released into the environment.
This program is about the spread of chemicals in the man-made and natural environments, and the immediate health and long-range genetic effects of such chemicals, the most deadly form of pollution. The topic was much discussed during the Stockholm meetings. The voice you heard at the start was that of Dr. Jack Schubert, professor of radiation chemistry at the Graduate School of Public Health, University of Pittsburgh. While discussing the genetic effects of chemicals, he warned in his presentation about the double deadliness of chemicals unintentionally piled one on top of the other in our environment.
And then what is more serious, you cannot set levels for one chemical and say we can reach that level for DDT or lead because we are a factor of 5 or 10 or 100 below it, because we are exposed to a combination of chemicals. And you cannot allow each chemical to reach its maximum level. You have to have a maximum level for combinations. And this is more not just a matter of theory, because we know that certain chemicals in combination produce harmful effects which are not manifested by the chemicals when tested alone. For example, susceptibility to infection in certain experimental animals, rats and mice. You may give an animal a staphylococcus infection of a level which does nothing, no deaths, no apparent harm. Also, feed them DDT at levels corresponding to those in the human body with no effect. Yet, if you challenge an animal with the DDT with an infection, you find that the animal suffers, some may die, some get ill, they lose weight. Then, many of the chemicals to which we're exposed are of a type which our bodies have not learned to handle. The DNA, which is our basic hereditary material, is the same whether we're speaking of a fly or a man, elephant, or any other type of living being. However, DNA over the years has learned to adjust to certain chemicals. It can repair damage and so on. But many of these synthetic chemicals are a new type which the body has not adjusted to. The enzymes cannot necessarily deal with it. The DNA cannot deal with it. And so these can lead to effects, bad effects. However, we cannot say whether we've had bad effects or not, because simply the truth is that we have not had any studies on populations that we can definitely say this chemical is harmful. As a matter of fact, it's nearly impossible to carry out such epidemiological studies since we're already exposed to such a high level of potentially harmful chemicals. And we already have such a high level of certain diseases that, let us say, an increase of 10% could not be detected unless we had a controlled study involving millions of people, which is nearly impossible. So we must go by animal experiments. But even then, this is time-consuming and costly. Another problem we deal with is that people seem to think, and many medical people and scientists, think that genetic effects are theoretical, something that happens, that may happen 1,000 years from now, and by that time we will be able to do some genetic engineering. But the fact of the matter is that at the present time, our populations can hardly cope with the number of diseases that are now caused fully or partially by genetic factors. And we must have ways of testing and screening chemicals so that such chemicals which may increase the mutagenic or genetic deleterious effects would not be released to the population. Otherwise, we could have a genetic catastrophe. For example, if thalidomide, which produced the obvious birth defects of children being born without arms and legs, let's say that thalidomide lowered the IQ by 20%, we never would have detected this effect. So we might have had mothers, all of them taking thalidomide because of controlled nausea during pregnancy, and we would lower the IQ of the population 20% and never know it. We'd be too dumb to know it. Now, the other problem we have to deal with is that many chemicals get into the food chains. They get into the water and the air, and then bigger animals eat smaller animals, and then the other animals accumulate these foods. How do we go about testing, and what can we do about these things? The test systems to be carried out must be the type that first tests for genetic effects in animals before going on to what we call long-range toxicity tests. This is very expensive and very time-consuming. By using such screening tests, one can then determine whether this chemical is worthwhile testing further. If it turns out to be highly mutagenic in a variety of test systems, then you don't have to go through these long-range test systems. You don't release the substance for general consumption. And by general consumption, I mean something that everyone in the population or most would be exposed to. I'm not referring to chemicals that people must take for life-saving measures or for medical purposes, because from the standpoint of population genetics, a few hundred people whose chromosomes are broken and so on does not mean very much. But when you expose a large fraction of the population, especially the young, who are much more susceptible, then you have a serious problem. In these testing protocols, the question comes up, who's going to do them? I must frankly state that you cannot trust any organization who has a purely economic interest to do the testing and then assure the public that the material is safe. Yes. I must say also that you cannot necessarily trust your government agencies.
Even more.
As a matter of fact, sometimes it's hard to tell whether you're dealing with a government agency or an arm of the industrial company, because many times the employees of the government agency go to work for the companies who they're supposed to regulate. So how do we handle such a problem? Well, one thing we must do is, of course, have the testing done, let us say, by a government-operated agency, but whose work is monitored and investigated and checked thoroughly by at least a tripartite committee consisting of government, the public, and industry. However, the final decision to release a chemical cannot be made by scientists alone, because it's sort of arrogant for the scientists to say, well, we will allow the public to have a certain risk because we need this chemical for making food better or preserving it and so on. Other problem we have to deal with is that there are many chemicals which we do not need. Many of the food dyes are unnecessary. Lead in gasoline is not really necessary if you operate different types of engines, because the amount of lead being spewed out into the atmosphere now is one of the most dangerous hazards at the present time, and is something that can easily and should be stopped. Now, how do we handle the problem of testing these chemicals before they're released to the public? Industry and government says it costs a great deal of money. We cannot do it. I think there are many ways this can be done. One is, in the United States, for example, they have a small tax on gasoline, which goes only to build roads. They raise $5 billion a year, and it seems to me a very small tax could easily support education in genetic studies, testing, and screening. In other words, this test systems that would be run by this tripartite government, industry, public could easily be supported that way. Or if one doesn't want a very small tax, then one can simply ask each government to produce 5 less bomber planes a year, and that would easily support these genetic studies without imperiling anyone's security. Well, how do we get any action? Some of the things, though, that can be done, one might say boycott certain industries, persistent publicity, and I mean persistent. A one-day demonstration does not do anything. Ask President Nixon. You have to have persistent picketing, let us say, with facts, but you have to go to the highest sources. I learned this years ago. If you want to get something done, you don't go to the clerks in a government office, you go to the top official. If an industry is polluting, then you picket around the clock, month in and month out, around the home of the president or chairman of the board. If you live in a country where you cannot picket the chairman of the board, then you picket their embassies wherever available, day in, day out. I think that we can use more subsidies. There's always a statement, too, about pollution and chemical control that it costs that people would lose jobs. As a matter of fact, in many companies that I'm familiar with, the workers themselves will demonstrate against the environmentalists because saying, you are forcing us to lose our jobs. This is not necessary. And even if a company has to close up because they are polluting or violating, there's no reason why subsidies can't be arranged to hire these people to work on cleaning up the environment. There are enough jobs to go around. So there's no need for anyone to lose a job because we are cleaning up the environment. Thank you.
What's gonna happen to the world and all the people? What's gonna happen to the fishes in the sea? Wait till yesterday they cried and we did, and the fish all died. This time fishes, maybe next time you and me. Time for a little social action, demand a little satisfaction. We got the whole wide world to gain or maybe lose. But the people couldn't understand that while they was sitting on their hands, standing still, they were still making a wrong move. Like the wild thing has learned to fear the hunter, man has learned to fear his own technology. Wait till yesterday he cried and our eyes were open wide, but our minds were closed and so we didn't see. Time for a little social action, demand a little satisfaction. Got the whole wide world to gain or maybe lose. But the people couldn't understand that while they was sitting on their hands, standing still, they were still making a wrong move. So the waste just kept on flowing in the river, and the bombs went off a mile underground. Wait till yesterday they cried, but we had no place to hide, and the next day not a living thing was found. Time for a little social action, demand a little satisfaction. Got the whole wide world to gain or maybe lose. But the people couldn't understand that while they was sitting on their hands, standing still, they were still making a wrong move. But the people couldn't understand that while they were sitting on their hands, standing still, they were still making a wrong move.
So much for the genetic and long-term effects of all the chemicals accidentally or thoughtlessly introduced into our environment. But what about the more direct and immediately dangerous ones? Here's Dr. Glenn Paulson of Rockefeller University.
Much attention has been focused on the potential mutagenic carcinogenic and teratogenic effects of chemical contaminants on man. Although there are many examples of this threat, it is generally considered, as Dr. Schubert said, a problem of the future, although there certainly are enough clearly documented case studies now to deny that. Equally as significant, and perhaps even more so, however, but much less often discussed, is, as a general issue at any rate, are the threats to human health that are not mediated through the effects of chemicals on the genetic material, on cellular DNA. Heart and lung diseases, for example, in the United States cause many more deaths each year than cancer does. In addition, heart and lung diseases very often cause, and I'm sure all of you can verify this from your personal knowledge of friends and relatives, a large number of debilitated human beings. Now, just parenthetically, there are natural cancer-causing chemicals, and that one can find areas in the world, non-industrialized areas, where the cancer incidence is quite high. Not suggesting that, therefore, this is a good reason to justify any additional burden of cancer-causing chemicals in the environment. Although anyone who is familiar with the controversy over radiation effects and radiation standards has probably seen statements by government officials and then by industrialists who make and sell various radiation-producing or radiation-requiring equipment that seem to indicate that. If background radiation, for example, has a certain biological effect, sometimes one sees lurking in the background a suggestion, well, perhaps a little more effect from a little man-produced radiation might not be that bad. I think certainly all of us would like to not add additional burdens to the natural toll of human disease and premature death. There are many very well-documented examples of the facet of the issue of non-genetic effects of chemical contaminants on human health, causing human disease or death, with a very distinct, in some cases quite sizable, and in some cases quite personally tragic toll already apparent. Earlier at the Environment Forum, there had been discussions of several of these diseases, I think in particular the human consequences of mercury contamination. Also, I believe there's been a discussion of the suggested effects, at least, of herbicide use in Vietnam on human beings. Other chemicals of this sort would include certain common air and water pollutants, as well as food contaminants, and there have been a few examples of these discussed. The outlines of the human toll from other contaminants, such as lead, which Dr. Schubert discussed briefly, asbestos particles, certain pesticides, and others are only vaguely apparent on the basis of currently available data. Now, many of these examples, of course, are quite familiar to many, perhaps all of you in the audience. What I'm suggesting here is that we try to go beyond the topical case-by-case, pollutant-by-pollutant approach and see this problem as a totality. It has been estimated that there have been something like 2 million chemicals made in the last 2.5 or 3 centuries that are, at a very basic level, unnatural chemicals, substances produced by modern chemical science and chemical industry, which have not before appeared on the face of the earth in a very literal sense. They are foreign to living things. It's not surprising that some, perhaps many, perhaps even a clear majority of these substances would have adverse biological effects on one or another organism if the dosage and the exposure route were proper. Another subcategory of this overall problem are chemical contaminants of the environment which are produced by nature, but in very small quantities or in areas where there are few living things to suffer from them. And this is the kind, again, of comparison where very often individuals or organizations which produce those pollutants, such as sulfur dioxide, weigh very heavily the fact that nature also produces some without considering the receiving environment that nature puts the pollutant into. My own recently completed research was an attempt to study synergism in mammals, in particular in white mice, between two quite common chemical contaminants of the environment, either DDT or dieldrin, which is a closely related chlorinated hydrocarbon pesticide, and other non-chemical stresses, such as, for example, a change in dietary composition, short periods of food deprivation, the stress of pregnancy in the female, and certain other physiological stresses, as I call them, the kinds of conditions which could occur in the normal life of a mouse, a wild mouse, or the normal life of a human being. And in short, what I discovered for both DDT and particularly for dieldrin was that one can find exposure levels in the diet, daily dosages, which have no apparent effect in the mouse for as long as half, two-thirds, even three-quarters of the mouse's lifespan. The animals seem quite normal by all apparent external criteria, weight, activity, etc., etc. If one takes these mice after some period of exposure and gives them a stress which could be easily survived by a normal mouse who had not been given the chemical pesticide, the animals die. And by and large, the higher the level of daily dosage of pesticide, the more of them die. As you would expect, it's a nice dose-response-related phenomenon. I think this is suggestive of two things. First, I think it has some implications for the lack of study that has been carried out in certain human populations that are exposed to quite high levels of these two specific chemicals. I think in particular of workers who manufacture them and agricultural workers who have used them in the past. Also, it suggests that this kind of synergistic or more than additive effect may be apparent if one were to look in large numbers of other combinations of two, three, or more substances. It's been estimated that there are something like 6,000 to 10,000 chemical substances, unnatural materials, if you will, in common use in industrial facilities in the United States. Official governmental standards exist for less than 450, that is less than 10% of these substances. This is for single exposure, let alone multiple exposures, which of course are quite common in industrial environments. It's further been estimated that in the United States there are some few hundred new unnatural chemicals put into industrial production every year. Estimates range from 300 to 600. There is a mechanism within the United States for developing allowable exposure levels to these chemicals. If 300 to 600 are introduced per year, one might expect to find 300 to 600 new standards per year. Unfortunately, one would be disappointed in that hope. Less than 50 new standards are developed every year to take care of the new chemicals for that year, plus the backlog of several thousand previous chemicals. Clearly, better study of workers could, and I don't mean this to sound as a sordid suggestion, but it could be used as an early warning system for the population as a whole, the human population as a whole. But we are not even taking advantage of the early warning system. This may strike you, as it does me, as a rather anarchic situation. I'll return to that point later. And unfortunately, the trends that I've mentioned suggest that, at least in the present social and economic climate in the United States and in the world, the situation that I've described may very possibly get worse rather than better if current trends continue. Obviously, the idea of a registry of compounds, something that is being discussed at the UN, is certainly a good idea. Who can be against record keeping? One would hope there would be certain guarantees that this registry be made extraordinarily comprehensive. There's a backlog of 1 to 2 million chemicals to catch up on. One might also suggest that there also be a registry of adverse effects of these chemicals, again, on any cell of any organism anywhere in the world, and that access to this registry be made quite easy for anyone who could show the need to know. I would suggest that in line especially with Dr. Schubert's comments earlier, that the arrangements of governments and of trade associations and industries, which often seem closely tied to governments, be looked upon with great suspicion by those of us who are outside of governments and outside of trade associations. After all, they have a vested interest, a vested economic interest, either in causing a chemical to be produced for which hopefully a very large market will be found. This, of course, argues against selective use of chemicals when they can be properly used. And the government bureaucrats in charge of this have a vested interest in keeping their jobs and keeping the loud voices, which they often hear, happy. More important, I think, for consideration here today are independent, non-governmental mechanisms for potentially dealing with this problem. It appears to me that there is a very strong need for independent scientific mechanisms for evaluation of the toxic effects of chemical contaminants of the environment. There have been some starts in this direction. Many scientific societies, for example, have journals, which are always a good source of information. But usually, the journals are focused on one or another type of hazard, not the overall problem. It also seems to me that citizens, non-scientists, or scientists when they act as citizens, could also use some mechanism of communication. It seems to me that we could all benefit if we had ways to inform each other on a global basis when one country, for whatever reasons, restricts or regulates or bans a chemical, because that valuable first precedent offers very strong support to efforts in other countries. I think the key question here is that anyone who's interested in this idea, it should be an effort of the potentially affected segment of the human environment. That's us, after all, us as human beings and us as people concerned about the environment, with few or no vested economic interests in the problem. I think that is an absolutely essential criteria, a hard criteria to work out, but an essential one.
Dr. Glenn Paulson at an Environment Forum panel on the effects of chemicals in our environment.
Only one earth, one world for the living. No second chances, no second time around. The sins of the fathers will not be forgiven. Generations they'll live on.
This has been Only One Earth, one of a series of documentary programs on global ecology, drawn from the Stockholm meetings on the human environment. Music was by Robert Ruzicka, and the series was prepared and presented by Alan Yates for Radio Canada International.
Sweet Mother Earth, we've treated you unkindly. Even though we know you've only meant us well, man in his haste has often blindly, oh, the story you could tell. Only one earth, one world for the living. No second chances, no second time around. The sins of the father.